From the Sky News Centre at 6, former Treasury Minister Stephen Timms has been stabbed at a community centre in East London. The Labour MP for East Ham was holding a constituency surgery in Beckton. His injuries are not thought to be life-threatening. A 21-year-old woman has been arrested. Our crime correspondent, Martin Brunt, understands Mr Timms was approached by an Asian lady.
She was talking to the MP, so she'd clearly been let in. She leant over and then stabbed him in the stomach. And again, according to the source, the MP was stabbed twice in the abdomen.
The father of a toddler punched and kicked to death by his mum says he can't comprehend what happens. Colette Harris has been jailed for at least 16 years for murdering Bobby Louch. The 21-month-old boy had 80 injuries when he died. The widow of a soldier who died in Afghanistan has appealed to the new government for better military equipment. Sergeant Paul McAleese died trying to recover the body of Private Jonathan Young. A coroner's ruled that both were unlawfully killed. President Obama has hit out at the companies involved in the massive oil spill off the US coast. In a speech at the White House, he said the underwater leak in the Gulf of Mexico could be catastrophic for the area. And he had this to say about the attitude of bosses when they were called before Congress this week.
You had executives of BP and Transocean and Halliburton falling over each other to point the finger of blame at somebody else. The American people could not have been impressed with that display, and I certainly wasn't.
New moves to prevent a series of strikes by British Airways cabin crew are underway. The conciliation service ACAS has offered to host peace talks. The next wave of disruptions due to last 5 days from next Tuesday. And police are looking for an entire flock of sheep which has been stolen from a Lancashire field. The 271 ewes and lambs worth more than £17,000 were taken near Bury. That's the latest. I'm Ben James.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time. Well, we're joined by local representatives from Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth in a minute. How do they think the election result will affect our environment locally and nationally? We also hear an exclusive interview from the heart of the latest phase in Thailand's struggle for justice and democracy. I spoke this afternoon to an English teacher in Bangkok whose school is now surrounded by barricades on the front line. And the Sun newspaper released this week answer phone recordings of singer-songwriter Michael Jackson sounding disorientated. But is the Sun itself distorting Jackson's legacy? We hear a different recording of Michael from around the same time in front of an audience where he sounds entirely lucid as he exposes corruption and sleaze in the music industry. But before all that, no Billy Quain this week, but we do have a political what's on for anyone rather depressed or disillusioned with politics right now. It's called Take Back Parliament, and it's taking place tomorrow. That's at 2 p.m. on 15th of May in Bristol on College Green. And the guys in London apparently have got together for an event on the 15th of May, so they're coming from London to Bristol at College Green. So that's taking place tomorrow on College Green, next to the Council House in the city centre, between 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. And the host for that event is Take Back Parliament and someone called Michael Harrott. Now, as Britain's new Foreign Secretary William Hague jets off for coffee and cookies with US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Thailand's long struggle for justice and democracy has taken another twist today. The so-called Yellow Shirts, the Thai royal family, and just like they did back in April the 10th, are again attacking the so-called Red Shirt protesters who've taken over large parts of the capital, demanding elections and a free press. Yesterday we heard that an army general who supported the Reds miraculously survived after being shot through the head by a mystery sniper. And today, two French journalists have also been killed by the besieging Yellow Army. Well, an old friend of mine happens to be an English teacher in Bangkok, and I gave him a call this afternoon to get his take on the latest phase in the Thai people's long struggle for justice against what's widely seen around the world as a corrupt and discredited monarchy.
I'm an English teacher here in Bangkok. My school is in Siam Square, which is on the border of where the Reds have made one of their barricades. I'm currently in the middle of the Red Shirt. Three people have just been shot, we've heard. But there's been battles going on since last night.
What makes you think that that these protests can really achieve anything?
Well, I think they represent the majority of the Thai people. The Yellow Shirts are the elite, the rich people, some of the middle classes, are the minority. Wherever you go in Bangkok, everyone supports the Red. You can see here that the people are being killed, and they're not moving. And it's old ladies, young boys, and it's just the full spectrum of, you know, the Thai people are here. It's very dangerous to talk about the royal family here. You could be put away for 15 years if they think that you're disrespecting them. But the general feeling is that once the king dies, there will be no more respect for the royal family, and that will be a major change. Within the soldiers and the police, there are a lot of red shirts, and so it just depends whether they're going to leave the army and police and join the protesters or not. But this will not end with the end of this particular protest in the centre of Bangkok. It's going to be prolonged and go on for years.
So how come you've managed to get tangled up in all this?
Well, I've been living here for 3 years now, and I didn't really take an interest in the politics, but since they were camped out outside my school, I couldn't help but come face to face with them. They've been speaking to me about why they're out here. They were just very good people with a genuine interest in freedom and democracy. For example, they were telling me last night, why in Greece can people protest against the government and not be shot? But in Thailand, every time they want to protest against the government, they get shot dead. They've got different tactics now to when they did on the 10th of April, because they're not coming in with troops as yet. They're kind of just using snipers and shooting from a distance. Because obviously on the 10th, they lost the battle. They lost their APCs, and they were chased away. The soldiers were chased away despite having guns. But all of the Reds here do believe that all of the recent terrorist attacks are false flag attacks carried out by the government in order to demonize the Reds and justify their reaction. People believe they will win because they've basically got rocks and bamboo sticks and they can beat soldiers with guns. It's quite incredible.
So that was a friend of mine who I can't name, unfortunately, because he's asked me to keep his name confidential. He's an English teacher in the Thai capital, Bangkok, and was speaking to me from his language school, which is on the front line with barricades around it earlier this afternoon. The Red Shirts United Front for Democracy have websites such as thailandvoice.com and UDD Thailand, and also UDD Facebook, which explain the six main demands of the Red protesters. But these websites are available from most of the world, except, believe it or not, Thailand. Now, Martin, can you tell us, give us a little bit of the background of the politics of Thailand, why we've ended up with this monarchy? And also, it seems incredible that back in April, on April the 10th, even though these protesters in Bangkok aren't armed, they've just got rocks and sticks of bamboo, they managed to beat off the army with their armoured personnel carriers, etc.
Well, I wouldn't claim to be an expert on Thai politics. Let's just say that before we start. As I understand it, the Red protesters are protesting in favour of Thaksin Shinawatra, who is actually in exile here, as many people are. I mean, Britain is a centre for political exile from the world. His supporters are mainly rural, poorer people who feel that the urban middle class don't take notice of their needs and their aspirations. And of course the urban middle class are not very happy to be run by somebody who's in favour of the interests of poor rural people. So that's basically the tension. They're wearing red shirts. That's not because they're socialists or communists. It's just the colour that they've chosen. But they are essentially the more populist party. And the establishment, the monarchy, the army in Thailand is more aligned with the IMF, more aligned with the Americans. And they don't want to change the situation because they're quite happy with it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you next, is do you think that there are external players around, you know, maybe from the West or from China, etc., interfering
absolutely.
In what's
I don't think the Chinese are playing a big role, but the Thai government and establishment is backed by the Western powers. Shinawatra is regarded as a bit of a he's actually a sort of businessman. He's you know, he's a wealthy businessman. I mean, like many countries in the world, you've got to be a wealthy businessman or woman to be involved in politics at all. I mean, that's just the way it is. But he's carried out when he was prime minister, he carried out policies like subsidizing credit for farmers and so on, which was good for small farmers. And it's mainly people from outside Bangkok who are the Reds who are coming into Bangkok to protest. I presume that the army have not been killing them so much as we've seen in other confrontations like this, because they don't want the publicity, and both sides are slightly wary. Although I understand that an ex-army general who's been advising the Red protesters was shot in the head yesterday and is in critical condition. And you know, that suggests that they're about to, you know, things are about to get nastier.
Well, what my friend, who I keep wanting to name but I mustn't, said as part of that interview there, was that the tactics this time that the army have taken on against the protesters have changed, and they're standing off from the protest itself and literally using snipers to just kill people one by one. How is this all going to end, do you think? And do these protesters really stand a chance of changing things by occupying a large part of Bangkok?
I would say that they've probably got a better chance of changing things in Thailand than they have in places like Burma, where the army is absolutely implacable. The Thai society is a relatively open society. Shinawatra used to be the prime minister, but was bumped out by the army, and then the right took control. The protesters probably are right to presume that they might be able to force the issue, but sacrifices have to be made in those circumstances. Just think how brave it is to be in a crowd of people where individuals are being shot by snipers, and you don't go home, you carry on fighting. That's real courage, isn't it?
Well, why is it then, as my friend was alleging there, and you were saying also, that Western governments are backing a corrupt monarchy against the people in Thailand?
It was ever thus. What do you think goes on in most third world countries? The population in general does not get a look in. The establishment, the wealthy classes, backed by outside forces, generally run most of these countries, and they have done for a very long time.
Okay, just to sum up there then, if you're interested in finding out from what the protest is about, these Reds, Red Shirts as they called, their websites are thailandvoice.com, and if you put into any search engine, not necessarily Google, UDD Thailand and UDD Facebook, which aren't actually apparently any more available from inside Thailand, you'll find out what their demands are. And they're posting up somehow, I don't know quite how, if they can't get to these websites from Thailand, quite regular updates about what's been going on in the capital on those particular sites. Now, I'm joined by Wilf Mound from Bristol Greenpeace and Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Let's start with you, Mike, since the microphone is a bit nearer to you. What's your thoughts on the results and fallout from last week's general election as regards the environment? How does it affect some of the campaigns that you've been running?
It's going to be a real mixed picture, and it's quite hard at the moment to say. But we, I think one of the things that characterises the politics of the environment is that it isn't automatically the case that one political party scores top marks all the time. I mean, the environment is peculiar in political terms because you've got to take such a long-term view. I mean, we're kind of, you know, trying to work towards a transformation of the UK economy that is going to bring down our carbon emissions to a tiny fraction of what they are now, 10%, 20% of what they are now, by 2050. That's many, many lifetimes and many parliaments to come between now and then. And if an environment gets sort of pigeonholed so that it becomes the preserve of one political party and it gets kicked backwards and forwards at each election, then we're never going to have the kind of long-term vision that we need to bring about that radical transformation. So our view has always been it's that what we want to do is we want to find the politicians at every level who understand the need for this transformation, and you find them in all political parties. When we did the analysis of the manifestos before the election, then of the three main parties, the Liberal Democrats were clearly out in front. They have a greener manifesto than Labour or Tories, so the fact that they're now in government, I think, is cause for some hope that we're going to get some environmental policies enacted, but obviously they'll be very constrained at how much power they really will be able to use.
Now, were you jumping for joy to see the first Green MP in Brighton, Caroline Lucas?
I think it's hugely positive that the electorate in Brighton thought in sufficient numbers that it was really important to have a Green MP in Parliament. And I agree, you know, it makes a big difference to the dynamic of the political situation in an elected body. Once you've got just one Green person there, we've seen this in local councils up and down the country, you know, it really does. It's a landmark, and well done to the Green Party for that position. But obviously, you know, they will at present be wielding only a very, very small influence in Parliament, and it's the mainstream political parties that really we have to work with, and it's their attitudes and their policies that are going to shape the next 5 years, no doubt about that.
So am I right to assume that, that voting Green is the best for an environment from Friends of the Earth's point of view?
Well, we're quite politically neutral. We don't favour one political party over another. And as I say, if you're looking for politicians who actually kind of really get it in terms of the long-term need to for the country to go greener, then you don't necessarily find them exclusively in one political party. You get people who understand that in all political parties, and we will work with all of them.
Now, we're going to be talking to Wilf Mound in a moment from Greenpeace. But before that, I'm joined in the studio by Marina Morris, who's been looking at the green credentials of some of our leaders. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Today, I will talk about bicycle usage. When the British Prime Minister David Cameron moved into his new downstate home, he had a bicycle helmet in his hand. As a Conservative Party leader, he used to travel to the House of Commons by bike. There are also many photographs of President Obama riding a bicycle in and around the White House. During his recent visit to Denmark, President Medvedev discussed Russian bicycle usage and said, "I would very much like to have many cyclists riding the streets of my native St. Petersburg, as well as the streets of the other Russian cities, and hope that someday this mode of transport will be available to those running the country too." According to his explanation, Russia hasn't done very well with bicycles for a number of reasons. The main thing is the absence of a traffic culture. Russian cyclists are afraid to ride on the streets because there are no bicycle paths, and the problem of motorists' attitude to cyclists. The Russian president agreed that Russia can learn from its European partners, if only because it is such a healthy lifestyle. Worldwide annual bicycle production is estimated around 110 million, 2.5 times the number of cars produced, to this 58% of the world production made in China. Why are our leaders so keen to promote bicycle usage? The benefits can be largely attributed to three main headings: cost savings, improvement to the environment, and improvements to our health. I'm going to focus on the health issue. After just a few weeks of regular cycling, regardless of age, gender, or initial physical fitness, the cyclist will be fitter and enjoy a greater sense of well-being. Regular exercise such as cycling halves the chance of the suffering from heart disease, the single largest cause of death in Britain, and provides protection from strokes, diabetes, and certain types of cancer. Cycling is one of the most enjoyable and effective workouts. Even a small amount of cycling can lead to significant health benefits, according to the British study involving 99 volunteers. The Department of Health recommends that people should take part in moderately intensive activity lasting 30 minutes at least 5 days a week. Health experts believe cycling provides one of the most effective forms of aerobic exercise, as well as being convention and exhilarating. In June 2008, Bristol was named the country's first cycling city, and it was awarded £11.4 million of central government funding to match £11.4 million of local money to improve and promote cycling within the city.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, let's go and over to have a chat to Wilf Mound from Greenpeace. Wilf, did you cycle here today?
No, came by public transport.
OK. Now, what's your thoughts about what Marina had to say there? Because do you think it really makes a difference if our leaders use bicycles? Or is this just sort of tokenism?
Well, I think it's encouraging to see them set an example, and whether they're doing it for self-promotion or to get over the issue or not, I think it does have an impact on people. We should expect them to set examples, but of course nowadays they're surrounded by security guards and whatever, so their freedoms are pretty limited.
Okay, now
it's quite easy to knock them off a bike.
Now we all think about Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace as two sort of pressure groups in the environmental field. What separates what Greenpeace do from Friends of the Earth, or are they just basically doing the same kind of job?
No, I mean the main criterion that separates Friends of the Earth from Greenpeace is that we engage in non-violent direct action, and that has great effect and raises the publicity. We're very, from the very start, when people set off on the Phyllis McCormack, they're very media conscious, and the media bombs have always flagged up very effectively the things we do. And non-violent direct action is the main separating thing. There's a lot of cooperation between the head offices and in the campaigning on the ground.
So what about this whole issue of the potential new nuclear build along the Bristol Channel? What are your thoughts about how the election has affected the possibility or otherwise of that? Because obviously Labour were planning, at least this was in the pipeline, two potentially new nuclear power stations. Are you aware of whether the election has changed the possibility of that happening or not?
I think the possible change is in when you look at the coalition agreement in full on the environment and the fact that they are emphatic that there will be no public money. Now, the previous Labour government said that, but that was a deceit because they've given or they had budgeted £80 million to Sheffield Forgemasters to develop some of the mechanisms for nuclear power containment. So I think we're more optimistic now. But of course, you always have to look at who are the sort of real kingmakers in the nuclear industry, and that is the French. I mean, the French are desperate to sell their product abroad, and of course it may come that given the French nature of some of the people we have supplying our own energy and who are keen to build nuclear power in Somerset and the area around here, it may be that you'll end up with the French government subsidising it.
Now, I've just had a little nightmare, and that is that the Royal Bank of Scotland gives a great big loan to some company with our money, our yes. taxpayers' money, in order to build some nuclear power station. Do you think that's feasible?
Well, we have lots of information on the Royal Bank of Scotland. They, in particular, they're financing BP with the tar sands, and that's one of our current campaigns. You know, the tar sands in Canada are the biggest disaster on earth, apart from the one in the Gulf, which is also BP.
Can you just explain that? Because many people haven't heard of that. What's going on there?
Where?
The tar sands in Canada.
Well, there's, as you know, there's a lot of chatter about peak oil and documentation and whatever, and that resides, I think, primarily around the hegemony of the US on the oil control mechanism. I mean, if you look at it, there are contradictions, isn't there? We're using less oil now than we ever have done, yet the price is going up and up. Now, why is that? And that's because people are looking at accumulation of interest, and we don't look at the reserves of Russia and Iran. I mean, one of the big things, the big circle around Iran, isn't just a nuclear power option, which we're using as an excuse. It's the fact they've got quite good oil reserves, which we have always tried to get a hold on. That's not happening at the moment, so we are having sanctions to cease their oil production. But in terms of tar sands, it's a desperate move to extract oil from the least attractive option, down, say, 500 feet below the boreal forest in Canada, particularly in Alberta, this is, there's this mixture of bitumen, sand, and tarry oil, which takes an enormous amount of energy to extract. They then use an enormous amount of water and acid to extract the oil and process it, and they, in the process, they have stripped the boreal forest. They've driven the indigenous peoples off their treaty lands. They're poisoning the river so that the fish, which the indigenous people rely on, are now no longer edible because they're cancerous. And we also see that if you look at the space photos, you see these great big tailing ponds, which are attractive to birds flying over. But when they land, they just get consumed by the acid. And so it's one of the biggest disasters on Earth, but it is all based on this fact about the price of oil. If the price of oil dropped dramatically, it would probably cease. But there are tar sands throughout the world. I mean, what we are...
So you're saying you think the industry is keeping the price artificially high?
Well, there are a number of mechanisms operating to keep the price high, you know, and that's one of the reasons why BP are looking later this year to invest in the Athabascan tar sands in Canada. We are protesting about that, and we are campaigning against it. And in 2007, we set up a special new Greenpeace headquarters in Edmonton to deal with this. And we've subsequently taken direct action, had people arrested and so forth. And we've had Indigenous peoples over here at the Arnolfini to tell us their story back in October through to December. So we think it's a big issue. It takes it produces three times the CO2 per barrel of oil that normal extraction does, and it's a major disaster. Already breaches the Canadian target for CO2 emissions, and we think it should be dealt with on an international scale. We will be looking at the pension funds, in particular, say, the Avon pension funds, because there are investments in BP there.
So this is an aspect of the whole way that the environment is affected that many people just don't see, is the fact that we do have, you know, many of our savings in these pension funds, and how do they then actually make a difference to the environment ultimately there? Because are they just looking to invest in something that looks like it's going to bring a quick return or what?
Well, that's right. They supply investment, and that gives things like BP and Shell the opportunity to, in their turn, develop things like oil fields and whatever. I mean, we are now attacking BP and their logo because they spent a lot of time when they became from British Petroleum to Beyond Petroleum. they spent an enormous amount of time and prestige on developing this logo. So what we now are campaigning on is we have their logo in big size A1 poster, and we're asking people to pull off a petal and either paint it black and stick it on our No Tar Sands billboard, or to write a message on the back and stick it on, as well as fill in a form which we will send to BP.
But you're not asking people to boycott BP petrol stations, because it doesn't seem to really make much difference which petrol station you buy it from. They're all just as bad as each other, surely.
Well, coming to the petrol station, our campaign at the moment is four strand. I mean, we've had a direct occupation. We took over their AGM. They always have their AGMs in an area where you can get into the roof and drop down in front of the executive just as he's about to make his speech to the shareholders. They conceded a 10-minute speech from Pep Benedetti, our campaigns for us, but we also had orangutans outside, because that's one of the main issues that you know. I'm sorry, I'm confusing that with the Nestle thing. I'm just trying to say the direct action thing. And so what we've done in Athabasca is to lock on to some of the equipment and try and stop that.
But I'm glad to hear you're turning up at their annual general meetings. That is, I think, you know, is essential, really.
That's later this year. But, okay. I mean, the whole point is, I mean, with Shell, a few years ago, we bought shares in it and turned up and got a motion through when Brown was there. I don't know what we'll be doing this year. But the four strands we're attacking BP on at the moment are getting these letters sent, and we've been doing very well, though people are ignorant of tar sands on the street. I have to explain it to them. We ask people with a leaflet to redesign their logo in keeping with their environmental policy, and we're looking at sending as many emails as possible to the chief, and we're also be investigating BP stations. But if you scan for a BP petrol station in this area, the only ones we've come across are at Winterbourne and Keynsham, and one on the Ouse services. So there aren't that many around. So it's not like when we did the Esso campaign, you could find lots of Esso stations to go and upset. And we won't be boycotting at this stage. What we're trying to do is just pressure and bring them round to the fact that this is a major hazard to the planet. It breaches all the sort of treaty obligations. And now with their Gulf problem, it may be that they won't have the money to invest anyway.
So what about more locally? I mean, all this stuff is very important elsewhere, because obviously we've got a shared environment, a shared atmosphere that we all need to respect. But what about locally? Are there any campaigns that Greenpeace is focused on within a stone's throw of Bristol?
Well, the Bristol Greenpeace Group, it, as distinct from Greenpeace UK, will carry on countering the biofuels application at Avonmouth, which has now had an appeal lodged against the council's decision.
And this is a biofuel energy plant, isn't it?
Yes.
Which was turned down.
Which was turned down by the Bristol City Council Development Committee North, but mainly not on legal grounds. The officers recommended it, but a majority of the elected members voted it down. W4B have now lodged an appeal, and we are now looking at how to counter
so
that.
So why are you so against these ecological fuels?
Well, it's not that ecological. When you look into depth about the biofuel arrangement, the Friends of the Earth have done a lot of work on this. Kenneth Richter at Friends of the Earth, who came down and protested with us. It's now being questioned about the destructive effect of some biofuel sources. And that's now really under debate and reconstruction by both the European Union and our own government.
Sounds to me, Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth, that you do a lot of the research, and you pass it over to these Greenpeace activists, and they go out and actually do some action on the ground. Is that true?
No, it isn't. Greenpeace do their own research, so they have a solid scientific base for their campaigns as well. But
what about this biofuel thing? Can you just explain that?
Yeah, we're strongly in favour of grassroots action, and we do, you know, we promote it around the world. We're actually a network of over 70 different country organisations, some of which are called Friends of the Earth and some aren't, but we're Friends of the Earth International, and we're standing beside people taking action in support of their rights to a decent environment all around the world. And that's actually part of the reason why we're working, you know, on biofuels in here in the UK, because we're one of our partner organisations in Indonesia is extremely concerned about the impact on local environments, on indigenous peoples, of the march.
Now, look, it sounds great having ecological fuel instead of this old-fashioned fossil fuel. Yeah. Why is it then, and what information are you getting from your contact groups out there? What is going on the ground to make this biofuel unsustainable, as they might say?
Yeah, I think you've probably got to look there partly at the sort of political human rights issues there, where people are being dispossessed of their land, their sustainable livelihoods that they did have in the areas where they lived, being taken away from them as multinational corporations come in and buy up that land and transform it into biofuel plantations, which is in the long run destructive of the natural environment and actually impoverishes local people as well as removing their rights. But also there's the actual physical environmental effect of these plantations. It depends on where they're done, but there are certainly cases you can look at around the world where indigenous forests on peat soils are being stripped away, replaced with plantations, and actually that's putting more CO2 into the atmosphere as a result of degrading and destroying that original forest and the peat soils on which they grew. That's putting more CO2 into the atmosphere than you'll ever save by burning the biofuels in this country.
Now, you can see why people who are interested in these environmental issues are flummoxed, though, Mike, because on the one hand, we're being told fossil fuels are running out, we've got to find an alternative, and then when an alternative is found, we're told, oh, that's no good, because local people in the areas where these biofuels are being grown are being kicked off their land. So what do we do for energy?
Well, there are plenty of relatively benign sources of renewable energy that we can exploit, particularly here in the UK, because we're actually amazingly well placed. You know, we're on a windy island set in a sea where the storms break around our coasts, you know, pretty much any day of the year.
So would you like to see these big windmills on the hilltops around the Mendips and all these Cotswolds, etc.? It's going to ruin the environment as well, surely.
We're not, we wouldn't say that there should be a blanket sort of permission to put up wind turbines absolutely anywhere, and we fully accept, we have campaigned for protection of special landscapes and areas which are important for their wildlife, and we fully accept that there should be areas which are like no-go for wind turbines. But then I don't think you'd say that putting up wind turbines in the port of Bristol or Avonmouth was going to ruin the landscape. And there's a huge potential, in fact I think they probably made the landscape rather better, and there's a huge potential for offshore installations around the shores of the UK. But onshore wind certainly is an important part of the industry, and if we hadn't had an onshore industry developing the technology over the years, we wouldn't be in a position now where it's becoming economically viable to build the offshore installations.
Can I just bring you in on this one, Wilf? What are your thoughts about alternative energy, and particularly in this area? Do you think it's a good idea to be building these wind generators? Is that a good alternative?
Well, I have to take issue with you. I mean, the simple recourse to renewable energy isn't just wind energy and windmills. And in this area, we're and in this United Kingdom, we're particularly well gifted with alternatives. Solar power is a very real option, both for our housing and for our institutions. I mean, we have in the coalition agreement in full, there's a commitment to look at marine energy. Well, that includes the Severn. But I mean, if you look at the analysis that's been
done, this is tidal power, is it?
Well, it could be tidal power. It could be something else. The wind farm in the Severn is one option of your wind power at sea. And we also have lots of other options available. But if you go back to the study that was done on the potential of renewable energy onshore and offshore in Scotland, they could provide all the energy we need. It just so happened that Gordon Brown wouldn't invest in that because it would be a boost for the Scottish National Party, who are still trying to claim back the £120 million that is lodged in a London bank that Scottish taxes have paid for. And he thinks that if they get that money back, they can green their economy quite rapidly with lots of jobs. But, you know, there are very many options, and nuclear isn't one of them.
Okay, Martin, do you want to chip in here? Martin Summers is here, our old Labour economist. Martin, what are your thoughts about energy policy and the environment?
Well, I'd just like to comment on what both of our guests have been saying here. We were talking about oil prices earlier. One of the things that makes oil prices so sticky upwards is speculation in the financial markets. So basically, we've got a bubble-run economy. So speculators push the price of oil up, and as the price rises, they can then sell futures contracts, all of which leads to great instability. But of course, there is now a commodity bubble around oil, which then of course makes tar sands viable supposedly, whereas in actual fact they're not viable if we're looking in the long run at the long run prices. When we're talking about biofuel. Don't forget that food prices are rising all over the developing world because land is being taken out of production for food to be producing biofuel. So I think it's not really moral for us to stop people growing food so that we can run our cars. That's not really moral at all. And in Colombia, I'm involved with the Colombia Solidarity Campaign, 4 million people have been displaced by violence, mostly by right-wing paramilitary groups. But once those people have been displaced, big companies move in, and what do? They grow biofuel.
BP, Casanare.
Yeah, the Casanare, BP and all the rest of it. And of course, the other thing that hasn't been mentioned in terms of alternative energy and renewable energy is perhaps we've just got to be a bit more efficient in our use of energy. So instead of arguing about where are we going to get energy from, perhaps we should be just trying to reduce our energy footprint. And the beauty of that is that the technology for it already exists. We know what to do, triple glazing and all the rest of it. It's cost money, but we need to spend money because we need to spend our way out of the recession. I'm not sure the coalition agrees with that, but that's what we need to do.
But Martin, don't you think then, to a certain extent, that we've got hooked on cheap energy, that because energy has been so reasonably cheaply available, whether it's for our cars or heating our homes, that kind of thing, that we've actually got used to now.
We have.
Having lots of...
We have, and that's led to a massive misallocation of resources. So I've read stuff, I can't remember the guy who wrote it, saying that most of the suburban US is in fact unviable at certain oil prices. Yeah, because people simply can't afford to drive to work, they can't afford large parts of the US are uninhabitable without air conditioning. Now, at a certain point, you price yourself... If you actually misallocate resources over a generation or two or three generations, because you're on the idea that everything's going to be cheap, then of course you are stuck when you've got to change. But the obvious way to change is to reduce energy consumption, which doesn't mean reducing your standard of living. We waste so much energy all the time. So we've just got to retrofit
energy
everything.
Energy efficiency is the real winner that you can do very easily.
It's win-win.
And cut a third of our consumption.
Well, I want to ask Martin, I mean, to what extent is this projected rise in energy prices, which has already begun over the last few years, particularly with gas and electricity, big hikes in gas and electricity prices, to what extent is that a real rise in the because of the an increase in demand or lack of availability? And to what extent is it also the fact that these big energy companies are being consolidated and getting together and actually fixing the price upwards?
Well, the energy companies get together to fix the price upwards, but then the speculators, of course, buy spots, you know, buy oil barrels on the spot market, and they also push it upwards. There is an underlying problem of, you know, we've got 6 billion people, all of whom want a higher standard of living, and so there's more pressure on the demand side, and of course, oil is going to run out sooner or later. I mean, it's logical, isn't it?
But we're not necessarily saying that, are we? We just want to keep our standard of living the same.
Well, we can't. We can't. I mean, as Gandhi said a long time ago, there simply isn't enough planets for everybody to live like they do in the West. So we're all going to have to change our attitude. And that doesn't mean that we've got to give up a good life. We can have a perfectly good life, but we've just got to change our way of doing things. And that's what politics is for, isn't
it? Isn't a lot of the energy that people use actually in their daily commute backwards and forwards from work? Does this mean that we're going to have to be looking at the future of people who are living much closer to their workplace and aren't doing these sort of, you know, anything up to 30, 40 miles in each direction journeys every
day? Yes, all sorts of things will have to be looked at, won't they? I mean, the economic crisis, tragic as it is, and millions of people are going to bed hungry this evening because of it, tragic as it is, it actually gives us the opportunity to actually go in the right direction, which would never have happened otherwise. If we miss this opportunity, then we won't get another one.
Wilf, can I just bring you in on this? Do you think that there are opportunities in regards to looking after the environment better with an economic crisis? Is that a little bit extreme, Martin's saying?
No, I think the economic crisis brings home a number of realities that, you know, we refuse to face and which political parties won't tackle. I mean, a big issue that's never mentioned, and it was brought up when we ran hustings in Bristol North West and Bristol East, is the population problem. You know, what are we going to do if we have this projected 9 billion people and at the same time we're eroding soils and losing the opportunity, we're polluting the sea, so all the food sources are shrinking? What are we going to do? I mean, that we have opportunities. This year, the COP15 carries on, or not optimistically, and in point of fact, if you look at the Hartwell paper...
Sorry, what was the COP15 and the Hartwell paper? Well, this sounds a little bit complicated. You need to explain these things a bit.
We had this big meeting in Copenhagen, didn't we? And it was Conference of the Parties, and it was the 15th Conference of the Parties after the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, and that didn't come out with the satisfactory... things that we wanted to.
No, a lot of people that went along weren't actually able even to go to the conference, were
they?
That's
right. Well, that's not unusual. If you go back to Seattle and the World Trade thing, I mean, that's why it became quite fractionated, because there's a handful of people who want to sit in one room and make decisions, and all the other people have to stay outside. And that hasn't changed very much ideologically, really, although we now have new players like China and India and developing countries who are now standing up for themselves a little more than they used to. But the Hartwell paper is a Chatham House paper that's come out, I think it was embargoed until midnight last night, and it says that the Kyoto approach is the wrong way to go about it. You're not going to get all the nations to agree on target emissions and whatever. You now have to look at an alternative approach, and they spell out a number of options for going ahead on that.
Now, Chatham House is the Royal Institute for International Affairs.
Yes.
In London, as a sort of private club, really, isn't it?
Well, it's a private organisation, but
a think tank of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, it is a private think tank, but they come up with some pretty interesting papers, which you may or may not agree with, but at least they're thought-provoking, and they produce alternatives. And this is, the Hartwell paper is one of them. I mean, the people who go to it aren't necessary subscribers to Chatham House and whatever, but they do all work under the Chatham House rule.
Now, the Chatham House rule is this rule where you're not supposed to tell anybody, isn't it?
No, that's a misrepresentation. Chatham House rule is simply that if you come to one of the discussions, you can quote what happened and whatever, but you do not name a participant and you do not attribute a view to anyone. They can go outside of it and say, I said this, but that you can't go and say, we don't create. But you get the issues out, and it's the issues that really, because it's an attempt to remove personality from the issues.
Yeah, well, sometimes personalities are involved in these issues. Surely if they're good ideas that these people are coming up with, they should be happy to hold their hands up and say, it was me.
They will, because if you look at the... If you look at what will be the press release, you'll find that, you know, some of the participants are naming themselves and standing up.
But it sounds a little bit counterproductive, doesn't it, to tear up Kyoto and say, look, it's not going to work, after all that effort's gone into making it
work.
But
it's wasted effort. I mean, and if you look at it now, I mean, Brazil have come up and if you go back in, I don't know how far you go back, young Tony, but you know, in 1992 we had the Rio conference and local agenda 21 and whatever. Well, Brazil are now arranging another one for 2012 to come back to some of the issues that were laid down there but never implemented. And as you know, there must be over 400 national agreements that, you know, you don't have any legal force to implement, international agreements. But could I also say, apart from COP15 later this year in Japan in October, there is COP10 for the United Nations Year of International Biodiversity, because one of our crises is biodiversity, and we've been, Greenpeace has been flagging it up by going around schools and whatever and doing university talks and trying to get the council to flag it up. And now we find that, you know, there is something in the coalition agreement to attend to biodiversity, because biodiversity isn't something we should just think, you know, it doesn't concern us. Biodiversity depends whether we stay alive or not.
Why is that? Why?
Well, because everything depends on plant life. Even if you're not a vegetarian and you eat meat, the meat comes from eating plants. And if the plants go, you go. You know.
Okay, Mike, what are your thoughts on this whole energy question we were talking about a minute ago then, over whether it's, you know, whether there are good alternatives to, I mean, we've been hearing about the problems with nuclear, potentially with wind as well. We can't have wind farms all over the Mendips, all over the Cotswolds. What's your preferred alternative?
Well, I agree, of course, with Martin. First and foremost, the real kind of big prize, the thing to go for first, is the energy efficiency. But also, I think it's wrong to think in terms of renewable energy as something that only happens at the big scale. And one of the things that we campaigned for in the last parliament is something that goes by the name of the feed-in tariff, which sounds like completely obscure and meaningless. But actually what it means is that a householder or a local authority or a community organisation that generates renewable electricity from a photovoltaic cell on their roof or their own wind turbine or whatever can feed it back into the national grid, and they get a guaranteed long-term return on that. And that's immensely useful. It's absolutely what's needed to unlock the big scale investment in renewables at that smaller and medium scale. And already you've got local councils around the country looking at how they can be using their buildings, the land that they own, to start developing renewable energy sources, and then using that as a stream of income. As Martin said, the business about energy efficiency, triple glazing, or, you know, cladding, external cladding on single skin walls, all these sorts of things, they cost money. Thanks to this new tariff, local authorities that are investing in renewable energy actually have a guaranteed income stream, so they can then start doing the big scale, street by street, super insulating of houses in their areas. So we've got a bit of a win-win situation going here. And not only is it going to be saving councils and saving householders money, it's going to be cutting carbon emissions, leaving us with warmer and cozier houses to live in. What I really like about it, what Friends of the Earth is really enthusiastic about, is it's actually taking back some of the local control. So your idea about how you in your local area as a householder or as a local authority or a local business relate to the energy business is no longer so much. It's like you're kind of totally in the hands of EDF or another foreign nationalised huge company to provide you with your energy. You actually relate to a locally owned business that is responsible for a lot more of the generation and the distribution of the energy that you use.
Now, I know that Friends of the Earth gets involved quite a lot with planning applications. I mean, we mentioned this biofuel plant earlier on, which was rejected. Do you think there's any prospect that we might see a level playing field with these planning decisions? Because, yeah, as we know, the developers get the right to appeal the decision, whereas the local people and yourselves who are helping locals don't.
Well, I think one of the biggest backward steps that the last government took in terms of planning looks like we might be sort of rowing back on that a little bit. Under pressure from big business interests, the last government stripped away a lot of public rights from the planning system when it came to these big infrastructure developments. So things like the two nuclear power sites that you've referred to, not necessarily stations in the singular, there could be multiple stations and nuclear waste stored for up to 160 years on the site. So Hinkley and Aldbury along the banks of the Severn, those big developments would no longer be decided by the local authority, and there would no longer be a public inquiry at which you or I, Wilf, Martin, could attend, put forward arguments bring forward expert witnesses and question, cross-question the developers of the proposal, call into, you know, really test and probe their economic evidence or their safety case or their case on the need for these developments. All that, all those rights would be removed, and the decision instead would be taken. Firstly, the government would just put out a statement they call the National Policy Statement, and it would say, we need up to 10 nuclear power station sites, here they are. And government had already produced a draft of that statement.
Well, that doesn't sound very democratic. That's a dictatorship.
It's not at all democratic. And then the final decision would have been taken by an unelected, unaccountable body based in Bristol, as it happens, called the Infrastructure Planning Commission. Now, that means not even MPs or not even the Secretary of State for Energy would make the final decision, but some, you know, quango based in an office down by Temple Meads. Both the Tories and the Lib Dems had said that they were opposed to that system, and we understand that the Infrastructure Planning Commission, the IPC for short, is going to be wound up. But, you know, we've got to see what remains of that old system that has just been abolished. It may well be that that system for fast-tracking, where the public and the local authority are shut out of the system, you know, elements of that may still be in place. So it's all a bit up in the air. There's a lot to play for, but certainly the draconian system that the previous government had introduced, which allowed them to just push through a huge nuclear program at 10 sites around the UK, we're not going to see anything quite as drastic as that.
Okay, before we go finally to Wilf, can you just tell us how people who are interested might get involved with Friends of the Earth locally? Do you have a local group as well as your office in Picton Street?
Yeah, we do. We have an active local group here in Bristol. We've got a website, bristolfo.org. We've got newsletters which are sort of left around the place, and we have public meetings, group planning meetings, which are held every month and which people are very welcome to attend, or they can just contact Friends of the Earth.
What part of town are the meetings in there, if people want to come along?
It's presently held in the city centre in King Street, just next to the Old Vic, and that's pretty accessible location for people.
How do people get in touch with you if they want to?
The best way to get in touch with Friends of the Earth nationally is just to contact our switchboard, you know, find us.
Well, I'm thinking about locally, really.
If it depends on what kind of issue you want to contact us about, because it may be that the local group, and we have a network of local groups, about 30 local groups across the southwest, is the right people to talk to. So I'd always recommend going to our national switchboard first, particularly since I'm only part time and I spend a lot of my time out of the office. So it's 0207490 1555 is our switchboard number, and it's www.foe.co.uk, and find us like that.
And how about you, Wilf? Can you just tell us about Greenpeace's activities locally?
Yes, I'd just like to come back to the big energy problem. I mean, we've been arguing for years, and we circulated all MPs with a DVD on decentralised energy, which we go for, and we also favour what's being established in the coalition agreement in full, where they're saying that they're establishing smart grid and the rollout of smart meters and the full establishment of feed-in tariff system. So, I mean,
what does that mean?
Well, that means that just exactly what Mike was saying, that, you know, anyone and everyone can generate their own electricity and sell the surplus to the grid.
Oh, okay. This is like solar panels on the roof, this sort of thing.
If you look at what's happened in Germany, firms do that, and they generate a surplus so that their costs of energy are covered by the feed-in tariff system.
Okay, but can you tell us how people can get involved in Greenpeace locally if they want to?
If you want to contact the Bristol Greenpeace group, it's probably best to Google Bristol Greenpeace, but we meet the first Wednesday of each month in the Victorian Methodist Church, 1A White Ladies Road, and we will be out on the streets all the time in the next couple of months, campaigning against Nestle for their misuse of palm oil in Indonesia and their threat to the orangutans, and we'll be campaigning on tar sands, among other things. We'll be at the Thornbury Eco Fair on the 22nd, and we'll be at the Bristol Festival of Nature, Organic Food Festival, Bristol Harbourside Festival, St Werburgh's, hopefully. So we'll be around.
Okay, and I'll give contact details for Bristol Friends of the Earth and Bristol Greenpeace at the end of the programme. Finally, Martin, would you like to just sum up with some of your thoughts about the environment?
Well, I'll just pick up some of the points made by our colleagues here. The Kyoto Agreement was based fundamentally on this cap-and-trade idea, it seems to me. That is essentially a hedge fund. Come on, people want to trade rights to pollute. It's a market solution for what is not, which can't work, in my view. I think we've got to go back to old-fashioned planning. If we want to decide how much carbon dioxide we're going to emit, we've got to decide what the limit is and plan to emit that amount. There is no market solution, in my view. It's just another way. The hedge fund people, by the way, are very, very keen on this cap and trade idea because they're running out of things to bet on, and that would be something else that they could chuck their money at. I mean, Friends of the Earth, I noticed at Copenhagen, were very clear in not agreeing to cap and trade, and I was very pleased to see that because I thought that you might have been tricked into that kind of game. Yeah, it's all a lot of rubbish, you know. I mean, we need to get back to what I would call old-fashioned socialist planning. You know, like Britain used to have to plan how much coal it dug in World War II. You decided how much you wanted to dig, and that's what you did. In La Paz in Bolivia, there was an alternative climate change summit, which I presume your organisations were represented at. That's the way forward. The business as usual people, it's all very well talking to them, but don't presume you're going to get any sense out of them. If you want something done, you have to organise it yourself from the grassroots. I'm sure you both know that. The problem with nuclear power, as far as I can see, is it just doesn't pay its way. That's where the market is useful, because the market just gives you a clear signal. It's too expensive. Forget it.
Martin, thanks very much for summing that up. And as I said, I will give contact details for Bristol Greenpeace and Bristol Friends of the Earth at the end of the programme. Now, in answer phone recordings from several years ago, the Sun newspaper this week ran an exclusive which appears to portray Michael Jackson as a disorientated, paranoid addict. After his suspicious death, Michael Jackson's doctor is being investigated for murder. So could Jackson have been killed because he was a rich and powerful artist who challenged the US music industry and American government's so-called war on terror? We hear a different recording, not reported by the Sun, of Michael from around the same time as those answer phone recordings, in front of a concert audience, where he sounds entirely lucid as he exposes corruption and sleaze in the American music industry.
You know, let me just say this. The tradition of great performers from... And I really want you to hear what I have to say. The tradition of great performers from Sammy Davis Jr. to James Brown to Jackie Wilson to Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly. The story is usually the same, though. You know, these guys work really hard at their craft, but the story ends the same. They usually are broken, torn, and usually just sad. And the story is very sad in the end because the companies take advantage of them. They really do. And Sony... Sony, you know, being the artist that I am at Sony, I've generated several billion dollars for Sony. Several billion. And they really thought that my mind is always on music and dancing, and it usually is, but they never thought that this performer, myself, would outthink them. We can't let them get away with what they're trying to do, because now I'm a free agent. I just owe Sony one more album. It's just a box set, really. It's with two new songs, which I've written ages ago. Because every album that I record, I write, like, literally, I'm telling you the truth, I write at least 120 songs every album I do. So I can do the box set and just give them any two songs. So So I'm leaving Sony, a free agent. Owning half of Sony. So I own half of Sony's publishing, and I'm leaving them, and they're very angry at me because of it, but I just did good business, you know. But
that was Michael Jackson there speaking in 2002. This time of a short break with Sony. Rather than managing artists and distributing their works, some music companies treat artists like their own private property, showing a very different picture of Michael Jackson there to that portrayed this week in Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper and elsewhere. And we have the second half of that, which is the sleazy half, next week. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest, please go to our webpage, thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Liberal Democrat Cabinet Member and Councillor for Ashley Ward,
you
Dr. John Rogers.
BCFM.
And thanks to Martin Summers and Marina Morris,
BCFM,
Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, and Bristol Pain Priest Wilf Mound. You can contact Wilf on 0117 927 6322 and Friends of the Earth, foe.co.uk.